Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Our next speaker is Dr. Fred Weaver. Fred is a professor of surgery and chief of vascular surgery at the University of Southern California, a known expert on open and endovascular repair of the aorta, and will talk to us about traumatic injury. Fred?
Thank you, Mike. This is a tough act to follow, being a follow-up on those two. Linda, you should have been a comedian. You've got the greatest wit of any vascular surgeon that I know of from the podium. I really enjoyed that. I'm going to talk a little bit about the mundane, just the management of traumatic aortic injury, and I'm going to focus predominantly. I do have disclosures that I do receive consulting and grant support from W.L. Gore. Focus mostly on blunt aortic injury, and if you talk about non-IFU application of endovascular technology, this is certainly a topic where that is the case. I'm going to talk about the classification and patient triage, the timing of repair, and the current status of endovascular repair. And really what's happened over the past decade is a total paradigm shift in how blunt aortic injuries are managed. Now, just a little bit of background, the epidemiology of blunt aortic injury and hospital admissions is really quite small. If you look at patients that actually survive, come to the hospital and evaluated, the actual percentage of patients that actually have a blunt aortic injury seems to be quite small, but it actually is only the tip of the iceberg. And if you looked at the Los Angeles train crash in 2008, and this is data from Dr. Dimitriadis at our trauma center, there were 25 fatalities, and of that, eight of them on autopsy had a traumatic aortic rupture. And this is something you consistently see through autopsy studies, that actually when you have mass casualty, blunt trauma types of situations, that about a third of patients that do die from a blunt aortic injury and rupture. And that actually becomes important when you look at some of the data that is coming out with regards to the management of these injuries with endovascular means. Now, just briefly, the mechanism of injury is actually the traction and tear in the ligamentum arteriosum. That's the most common place for a blunt aortic injury to occur. Doesn't mean it doesn't occur in the ascending aorta, the transverse, the arch, or the abdominal aorta, but those are really small percentages, as you know. Most of them occur right at that, just distal to the left subclavian at the ligamentum arteriosum, where the aorta is relatively fixed and otherwise mobile for most of the descending thoracic aorta. And classically, the chest X-ray has been the screening modality. It's a poor screening modality, particularly in multiply injured patients. You will miss a significant number of blunt aortic injuries if this is all that you use to screen for those injuries. And of course, with the availability of CT scan and the increase in the technology, there's been this huge paradigm shift, nicely demonstrated by these two studies from the AAST, moving from CT scan kind of being used selectively as a diagnostic tool, certainly not the gold standard definitive tool prior to repair in the 90s, to a point where it is not only the diagnostic tool that is liberally used, but is also used to definitively not only diagnose but classify these lesions and then to treat based on those, on that classification. And why is that? Well, you know, the images that we are getting from these from CT scanning are just spectacular. This is actually a nice example of an endoluminal view of a blunt aortic injury, as shown here. Now, the management of these injuries has really changed dramatically over the course of the last decade. And I'm going to talk a little bit about stabilization and injury assessment, and I'm going to talk about timing of repair, and then the type of repair. It's become quite clear that delayed repair of blunt aortic injuries is actually the way that things should be done. And the management principles of that are that in the multiply injured patient, you have a number of different things that need to be attended to rather quickly. The blunt aortic injury appears to be one that does not need to be attended to immediately in most cases. Now, these are generalizations. There are certainly exceptions. But it's become clear that aggressive pressure control, beta blockade, limited resuscitation, and attention to the other injuries actually helps as far as outcomes are concerned, and I'll show you a couple of studies from that regard. Now, certainly large aortic injuries may rupture during this observation despite pressure control, but this is certainly the exception, not even close to the rule, which is a new way of thinking when you think about how we managed these patients two decades ago. Now, in our own institution, Al Yellen and Quint Stiles, and this is quite prophetic, actually in 1985 published a paper that was roundly criticized, I might add, about the more delayed and deliberate management of injuries to the thoracic and abdominal aorta. Now, these included both blunt and penetrating injuries, but it became quite clear looking at their data that you could be quite deliberate about treating most aortic injuries, as long as they were carefully managed and observed. And Don Trunke was quite critical of this paper, actually. And Quint Stiles' response to one of his criticisms simply says, "We simply had confidence in the adventitia, and I see no reason to change my mind about that." And actually, that is a pretty important point, that the adventitia in these blunt aortic injuries actually is the thing that allows us to be more deliberate about the management. Now, if you look at, these are two studies, early versus delayed repair with no major associated injuries. So you kind of take that confounding factor away. There was a statistically significant, although p-value was not 0.05, in favor of a delayed repair in patients with no associated injuries. So in other words, rushing the patient to the operating room, endovascular suite, or whatever, actually increased the mortality. And a more delayed approach with resuscitation, get your ducks in a row, and do it in a more elective setting, actually provided an improved mortality. And from the Utah Trauma Registry, looking at 145 repairs of blunt aortic injury, the only independent factor for survival against mortality was a delayed repair. There are a number of other studies that I could show you, but I think it really has become very clear that delayed repair in most situations with careful blood pressure control is acceptable and actually beneficial in most patients with a blunt aortic injury. Now, there's been a classification scheme. Ali Azadeh and Ben Taub put together a classification scheme with regards to these injuries, and it's actually quite helpful, and it tags on to what Ben Starnes just recently published in JVS with regards to management of these injuries. Grade 1 is simply an intimal flap. Grade 2 is a intramural hematoma. Grade 3 is an actual tear, but contained within the adventitia, as Quint Stiles said he had confidence in. And grade 4 is actually a free rupture. And as I showed you the earlier data, rupture is the most common consequence with death. Most patients don't make it to the hospital following these injuries. But when they do, occasionally they will have a rupture on presentation. And actually Ben Starnes and his group at Washington has looked at this, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Now, this is a paper that just came out in JVS looking at a significant a cohort of patients from Harborview at University of Washington. And there were some important observations here. Number one is that the observation alone with a follow-up interval was reasonable for an intimal tear. In other words, intimal tears, certainly small intimal tears, do not require repair. And he defined small as less than 10 millimeters. For larger intimal tears, a reassessment by CT scan within a week was appropriate. Without a progression or without the development of a evidence of extra mural widening, if you will, which would be more like an intimal tear that actually was masquerading as a intramural hematoma or actual frank tear with the adventitia containing the tear, that you didn't need necessarily to repair those either, and the intimal flaps that did not progress. Any patient that had some type of contour abnormality should be repaired. And one of the controversial things that he recommended, and he's actually got a paper in print from a larger experience at Harborview, is if the patient presents with a free rupture, don't bother. Use resources elsewhere. Don't even try to repair the patients because there was a 100% mortality in their experience that will be published in the next couple of months. Now, the debate about open versus endovascular repair, I think, is kind of open. I mean, kind of ended. I don't think there's any question that endovascular repair is the way to go. Certainly, there's caveats. Yes, this is a young patient population. Yes, we don't know what these stents grafts are going to do in the long term. But frankly, if you look at these numbers from a meta-analysis, they're pretty dramatic. Paraplegia rates and mortality rates are markedly reduced when you have an endovascular repair as compared to an open repair. And I think that's pretty much the status. I don't think anybody argues with this, and I think this is the way it's gone in most trauma centers. But it's not without challenges. The endovascular repair in these patients is different. It's not the same as it is for a thoracic aneurysm in an atherosclerotic 70-year-old. The aortic arch itself is tight. The curve is relatively acute. The devices that were available up until recently were very ill-suited to this anatomy. Diameter sizing is a problem because of associated hypotension in these patients when they present and they get their CT scan. The question of subclavian coverage, and I think I'm going to speak a little bit about that at the end, but I think this is an under-recognized problem. And then vascular access. Many of these patients don't really have big accessible vessels, and conduits may be required, although the lower profile devices may mitigate the need for that. And the biggest issue is stent graft malposition. If you talk about, you know, off IFU requirements, this area has been rampant with that over the course of the last 5 to 6 years, and this is just some examples. The bird's beak, this is the ultimate bird's beak right here with a completely malpositioned device. This right here is a bird's beak, and this is actually a collapsed stent graft that had a bird's beak with oversizing that had been performed at an outside institution, I might add. And just the bird's beak is simply this lack of apposition of this lower component of the device to the inner contour of the aortic arch. It's felt that that increases the likelihood of stent graft collapse with potentially catastrophic consequences. I think it's both this, but it's also this plus oversizing. And you maybe have an infolding because of the oversizing of the device in that location that leads to stent graft collapse. This is actually a patient that we cared for in our institution that had their stent graft placed in another institution and presented basically with complete collapse and occlusion of the stent graft in renal failure and ultimately in paraplegic, by the way. The patient actually ended up and had an open removal of this graft with reconstruction and unfortunately remained paraplegic, although his renal function normalized. Technical tips in dealing with endovascular repair: you have to have 3D reconstructions for this particular location, as is true for non-traumatic indications. Aortic undersizing, you just need to be aware of this, that patients that present that are hypotensive, the aortic diameter may be 5 to 40% less than it actually is, and that can lead to significant undersizing of the device. It's very, very difficult to account for that, obviously, in these patients, but it almost, if you can get them to a point where they're relatively stable, you're treating some of the other things, another CT scan prior to repair may be indicated to get a better idea of sizing. Devices have been a problem, although we now have an approved device that actually has worked well in this location. IVUS has been used not only to classify the injuries, but also with regards to sizing. It does increase time and complexity, but has been helpful in certain investigators' use. And then you don't necessarily have to use heparin. It's a plus-minus thing, which is a good thing if you have a head-injured patient. And it only usually takes one piece to repair these devices. Now, Gore had a transection trial, and these devices were recently approved for use in traumatic transections. It's a conformable prosthesis that has the capability of taking that inner curve of the aortic arch much more ably. And this is a similar kind of construct with regards to their other technology, endovascular technology, as far as delivery. And there's larger sizes that now fit the smaller aorta, which is, of course, very important in this particular age group. And this is just to see the new sizes that are available that will fit just about any aorta that you might want to treat this way. And now this is from the study that was recently completed. They had 51 patients, 57 devices were placed, so it's about one device per patient. 78% of these devices would have been outside the IFU of the previous first-generation TAG device, really substantiating the fact that we needed to have better technology in this area. The aortic diameters were relatively small as what we're used to, as compared to what we're used to in the atherosclerotic age group. The procedural details are really quite impressive, 100% technical success, procedural survival, femoral access in 96%. Left subclavian coverage was required in 63%, which is an important aspect of this. They only performed revascularization in two of those patients. 8% overall 30-day all-cause mortality, which is really quite impressive when you think about the associated injuries that these patients may have had, no major device events in the 30-day follow-up, and had really just one ischemic stroke. The rest of other kinds of things that could have occurred did not occur. So this is a really impressive series, and it's interesting because this is really the first prospective series of treatment of blunt aortic injuries of any type with this kind of data collection. So it's a very valuable series with regards to a reference point. So it was approved in January of 2012 and is now available for use in these particular situations. Now I just want to close with a patient that we took care of before that device, obviously. Had a traumatic tear, had a significant tear. She was treated with a delayed kind of a approach, basically stabilized, had multiple injuries, stabilized, and then treated on an elective basis. Had a very nice technical result. And this is her CT scan at 26 months. And as you can see, actually had a has had a very, very nice result. She's back now to, you know, doing her thing. She's a 26-year-old. The thing that was interesting about her is we covered her left subclavian. And initially we asked her, you know, how's your arm feels? Fine. She says, oh, no problem. And about 4 months later, she came back complaining of significant left upper extremity weakness and discomfort, and we ended up doing a subclavian transposition. She is not your typical trauma patient. So she did come back. But I think a lot of these patients that we do cover that left subclavian, I think this left subclavian is going to be a problem. And I think that we ought to be more aggressive about revascularizing that left subclavian in most of these patients. And they're very, very young. I just can't see that it's not going to be a benefit over their lifetime to have a subclavian in line with arterial flow. So there are new standards for BAI. Routine CT scanning is in all high-risk patients, and it's replaced diagnostic angio as the definitive test. You go right from there to repair. The delay in repair to a more elective kind of situation for most patients is advised. Non-operative management in selected in grade one, which is basically the intimal tears, the small intimal tears, is advised. And I think there's going to be some controversy with this, but patients that present with just free rupture, hypotensive, and in essence dead, trying to take them to the endovascular suite and treat them is associated with virtually 100% mortality. And endovascular repair is the gold standard replacing open repair. And with this, there's been major improvements in survival and the rate of paraplegia in this patient population. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.